Tune in to Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.
Ha ha ha!
Friends of the Earth have commissioned this study from the Stockholm Environmental Institute, showing how Europe could cut its emissions by 40% by 2020. Can you say why you chose that target to start with?
We choose 40% domestic cuts as the target because this is what science tells us is needed to avoid the worst effects of climate change. Developed countries would have to cut their emissions by at least 40% without offsetting to give us a decent chance to stay below 2 degrees.
Okay. It's much stronger than is already on the table, isn't it, from rich countries already. Isn't it about 11 to 18%, something like that, on the table?
It's more now.
It's gone up, yeah.
They're just adjusting the calculations up to the recent pledges, but it's
okay.
But it's still 20% or below even. So
yeah,
the current pledges are far too low in comparison to what science tells us.
Okay. And the other problem with the European target and all rich nations' target is, but let's look at Europe, at least 50% of the targets can be met by offsets, so it's actually like 15% domestic cut, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a huge problem because there's a high amount of offsetting in there, and offsetting doesn't work.
Yeah.
It does not deliver real emission cuts. Many of the offsetting projects in other parts of the world would have happened anyway. So we keep on polluting here, but it is not offset.
Yeah.
The emissions are still out in the atmosphere, and many projects have very bad consequences for people in the environment. That's why we think offsetting doesn't work.
Yeah, so you could say that the best option that Europe has put on the table at the moment is 15%, really, domestically.
Mm.
And you're showing how they can move to 40%, and that it's actually possible. Could you say some of the assumptions that are written into the report first, some of the things that you've ruled out as solutions?
Well, first of all, we did this cut without the so-called false solutions. It's things like nuclear power, so-called clean coal technology, aquafuels, and offsetting, because they're not helping to fight the climate crisis, but instead can even worse it.
Okay.
So so we did the emission cuts really with energy efficiency, energy savings, and renewables.
Okay.
And we also include lifestyle challenges because we believe we have to change the way we consume energy. So this is, for example, eating less meat, which is also based on a healthy diet, or flying less.
Okay. Just go back to those false solutions. Do you want to say for each one of them exactly why you've ruled them out, so why you don't think they should be included? So
yeah, so offsetting, obviously, because it doesn't work from an environmental perspective, as I just explained. Well, nuclear power, we don't think that nuclear power can ever be safe. There's no solution how to store the waste underground. There's a high risk that nuclear waste is used for weapons. And there's many issues around nuclear power, why we believe it's not a solution to climate change.
It's not effective use of money, really. It's more costly than renewables.
It's really expensive. Right? It's only working because we have lots of subsidies from the governments. And also, it's not true that nuclear power is emission-free.
Mm.
So if you take the whole life cycle into account, then nuclear power is as efficient as a modern gas power plant, which also has combined heating. So it's no option at all.
Okay. And biofuels, because Europe is doing a lot with biofuels. Mm. They've got targets and subsidies for biofuels. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, but they also adjust this because I think people realize more and more that biofuels can be really dangerous. Because you have to look again at all the effects, not only of using them in your car here in Europe, but also effects of land use change in other countries. So indeed, many biofuels cause even more emission than burning oil would cause. And we think that you shouldn't burn biomass in your car, but instead use it for heating. That's also what we do in the study.
Okay. So do you want to go into a little bit more detail about how you've achieved it?
First of all, the study is a detailed energy scenario, which is looking at different sectors like buildings, transport, the energy sector. And so for all these different sectors, the study explores how much can we save energy, how can we improve energy efficiency, and can we replace the current fuels, like fossil fuels and others, by renewables? So study assumes that we rapidly phase out coal power plants, fossil fuel, and also nuclear power, and instead replace it more and more with renewables and other sources.
And how are fossil fuels phased out? Is that through direct regulation and efficiency standards?
We also assume that there's a political will to phase them out. We can't give a complete, comprehensive picture of all the measures needed, but for example, one example would be that all the subsidies that still go into fossil fuels should be redirected to renewable energy or energy savings.
Okay. How would you encourage renewables? Is it a program of active public investment or some other incentive?
I think it needs a range of incentives. First of all, public subsidies, like I just said, redirection of existing subsidies or more money for research. But we have also good examples with the feed-in tariffs or tax systems, which help to bring renewables on the market. So you could think of similar or things all across Europe. It's also important that we have, a binding renewable target on the EU level, which is binding for all member states, and that one should be aligned with the 40% target.
Okay. And how will this impact on people's daily lives? How will this, I guess there's a huge body of public opinion that kind of thinks low carbon measures is going to be really tough. It's like austerity. It's like I'm going to be facing a lot of pain and I don't know. You can see the tabloid press raising their, writing their outrageous headlines.
First of all, we foresee gradual changes, so people might not even notice that things are changing that much. And we also believe that life in a decarbonized world, as we imagine it for 2050, would not be that different from today. And we also think that people, if you would suddenly place a person from today to that world, that the person would think it's a rather convenient world. So just to give some examples, for example, transport and mobility. We assume that the level of mobility that we have reached right now is enough. We all have freedom to travel and lots of options. And businesses usually would rapidly increase. We just imagine that people would have the same amount of travel freedom as today, but with different modes of travel. And so if you make trains more convenient, faster, and maybe even cheaper than planes, then people wouldn't complain about taking a train if it's a journey under 1,000 kilometers, as we assume.
There's also something in the report about a healthier, less meat-intensive diet. Mm. Is there a policy to bring that around to make kind of meat products more expensive, to build in their kind of environmental costs? Could that be done?
I think the meat question is really a complex one. Yeah. So I think it would have to be a mixture of really labeling food in a way that you can see if you're taking environmentally friendly choice or not. It could be pricing, especially for industrial meat production. But it also means that we really need more education programs in schools for children to show them how a healthy and environmentally friendly diet looks like. So I think these changes won't happen from today to tomorrow, but need kind of incentives on different levels.
Okay. One other thing that could be a way of doing it is maybe working with changing the agricultural subsidies in Europe, because there's a lot of money there and it could be directed towards more sustainable, low carbon or less carbon intensive kind of methods of agriculture maybe.
This is exactly what we're demanding. We think that it's insane that lots of money are really directed directly to the industrial agriculture, and you could really totally shift that subsidy system so that we subsidize organic farming with local farmers and sustainable options, which is both creates more jobs but it's also better for the environment and people.
Okay. Is there a particular way of driving down demand in the report? Because I don't know if you know that the Zero Carbon Britain report and George Monbiot's Heat, that quite what's the word? demanding, achieve quite demanding cuts in a very short space of time. Both of those scenarios only work by reducing demand by about 50%, maybe, by having some. And in both those cases, they use a carbon rationing system. But I know you're looking at kind of some kind of tax system instead. So
I think it would need different sectors, also different. Sorry, I think it would need different measures, also depending on the sectors. So regarding industry, we could imagine a series of binding measures that industry has to take, so that we also have norms what they have to fulfill regarding energy performance. It's different if you talk about houses, so that we need less heating of homes. There we also need different programs, which could be like money incentives or kind of giving loans to people to help them to finance this. And so I think it's very different. We got looking at the different sectors, and so we took a really adapted approach.
Okay. I guess the kind of big question is, it can be done in theory. Why isn't there the kind of vision and the will coming from Europe to implement something like that? Why are we so far away from what we need to achieve a stable, relatively stable climate and avoid the worst ravages of climate change?
Yeah, this is really hard to understand, especially since we're at a time where science is really clear in what's needed. This study shows that Europe can act accordingly to science, and it's possible. And Europe has a lot of options to do, but they are not doing it. As you realize here in Copenhagen, the performance of the EU is really disappointing. But we believe if they would realize what they can do, if they would step up their commitments, then we would see also some movement here in negotiations.
Currently the EU, you had enough?
No, okay.
Currently the EU is, its main policy instrument is the kind of cap and trade thing, which I know Friends of the Earth has been very critical of. But the effect seems to be to allow new coal build to happen. So in fact, we're locking in fossil fuel, high carbon fossil fuel infrastructure for decades to come. So it doesn't seem to be working, carbon trading. When are they going to wake up and see that this thing isn't working? There's no way it can be really reformed adequately for it to work quickly enough.
Yeah, well, theoretically it could work, but we are not seeing that governments are really closing the loopholes. The big problem is a huge lobby of industry, which we have seen when they negotiated the ETS. And there are still many, many loopholes left also for the next phase of the ETS. And we believe it's dangerous to only put everything on this instrument, because you need a series of other measures, like tax measures or carbon tax, for example, or other things. And what we see as especially dangerous is that the EU is planning to expand the European ETS even to other regions or even in the global south, which we believe is totally insane, because different loopholes would add up and would have a system which wouldn't cut emissions at all. So the only chance would be to restrict it to Europe and really form it, but we can't see that happening at the moment.
Over the course of these 2 weeks, do you think that there's some kind of shift happening in people's understanding about the carbon markets, and whether that's an effective way to go? I mean, the people out on the streets throughout next week are basically going to be one of their main critiques, is like the corporations have kind of taken over the policy agenda, and the whole Copenhagen process is going to fail because that's the main policy instrument at the heart of it. If the EU and the other rich countries get their way, rather than the majority poor world, is that going to change between now and the 20th of December?
I think, in the opinion of the public, maybe. For example, we have a worst lobby award where we show the where we show how corporates lobby governments to make them have bigger loopholes,
yep.
And there's also some trading in there. But if I look at carbon trading as such, I would say the biggest loophole is offsetting. And this is also the biggest danger, because if you look at what's happening here inside, and governments are really trying to push to have as much, as they call it, flexibility as possible. But since offsetting doesn't deliver, the amount of cuts is much lower than we saw. So this is one of the biggest dangers.
Okay. I think that's probably my questions, unless you've got any final thoughts you'd like to...
Yeah, maybe you could say something of the policy framework we mentioned for the study, or how to make this happen. We believe that making the vision of the study happen would really require that we have a completely different framework in Europe, so that climate legislation, climate change is really like the overarching principle. So we want to have a binding target at EU level for all member states also, that countries have to cut their emissions by 40% at least, and without offsetting. And at the national level, we are campaigning for national climate laws that would reduce emissions year by year in these countries and across all sectors. So that would be kind of the overarching policy framework.
I guess the other thing that comes to mind flicking through the notes here was that how much is this going to cost? Because that is... what always people, the other thing that people come back with is going to cost too much. We could never consider such a thing. I think there was one EU negotiator that said 40% cut is just completely ridiculous, off the table. But
I would say that 20% offer is completely ridiculous and should be off the table, because we're already at minus 10% and more emission cuts now. Achieving a 20% cut, they could do without any domestic measures and just like business as usual. So I think this offer is ridiculous. And if we are serious about the climate crisis, then the amount of money you have to pay for 40%, you have to compare against the costs of inaction. So this study talks about that the costs in Europe would be about 2 point something off the GDP of Europe. And if you look at the costs of inaction, Stern was already some years before talking about at least 5% or even more than 20. So I think this is a payoff in the long term.
Yeah. And it seems to me that if you allow climate change to accelerate out of control, the costs are kind of incalculable, really. They're almost like...
Nobody knows. Yeah. I mean...
But if you're sort of talking about, loss of life on Earth, it's like, I don't know how you can put a price on it. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good study and good timing, I think, with because it's what we need to hear in this conference, isn't it? It's one of the kind of top line things is rich country cuts 40% would be we'd be halfway to getting a good kind of deal out of this conference. Thank you.
chills me to the bone. But you don't know.
Welcome to the second edition of Copenhagen Daily. There's now two of us in Copenhagen. Frederica arrived yesterday and I touched down on Sunday. And then we've got two other people, Tom and Arthur, arriving on this coming Saturday. Please bear with us. Well, the first few programmes might be a little hastily put together, but we're rapidly finding our feet and getting into gear. I'm recording this at the Bella Centre, the venue for the UN Conference on Climate Change, which is where world governments are trying to come together to put an international framework in place to keep us secure and safe from the worst ravages of climate change. And with the signal from the scientific community warning of devastating impacts that could imperil much of life on Earth and the complete inadequacy of the political response, surely this has to be the most important meeting in human history. But on day two of the conference, all the omens are that this will fail. Here's why. Firstly, the level of ambition on the table from rich countries is inadequate. What we need to see is about 45% cut from rich countries by 2020 if we're going to return atmospheric levels of CO2 to 350 parts per million and stop runaway climate change. But the EU are talking about a 30% cut in emissions for rich countries as being the most that the conference could hope for, really. And even the European target is watered down. It includes an allowance for around 50% of that target to be made by offsets. So the rich country cut on the table is about 15%, and we need about 45%, so a long way to go. Then there's the issue of money. Hundreds of billions of dollars are required to enable poor countries to adapt to the impacts of climate change and to help them develop in a low-carbon way. Rich countries have an outstanding commitment to do this under the United Nations Framework Convention, which goes back to 1992. But right now, the EU, the supposed leaders in this game, have not guaranteed any new money at all. Currently, there is a danger that climate finance will simply come out of existing aid budgets. Also, the countries of the majority poor world have everything weighed against them. They don't have the personal power that the rich world has. And now, the rich are playing dirty. Not only did they put pressure on Algeria to remove the head of the African bloc after they took a widely applauded stand at the recent talks in Barcelona, it appears that rich countries have now put pressure on the government of the Philippines to remove Bernarditas Muller, one of the leading negotiators of the G77 plus China negotiating bloc, which represents around 135 developing countries. And it goes from bad to worse. The US, the UK and Denmark got together and wrote something that has been termed the Copenhagen Accords. It was a draft agreement which was circulated to just a handful of rich country governments and was leaked to The Guardian in the last few days. This has caused an uproar at the talks. It has been widely criticised. Basically, what it means is that rich countries want to foist on the poor majority world their version of the deal, which has everything in it that favours them and ignores everything that the developing world has been talking about at these talks for the last 2 years. It's deeply undemocratic, to say the least. The good news is that Friends of the Earth, Europe, have issued a report saying that Europe can meet its target of 40% by 2020, and they've shown how. The other good news is that the EPA in the United States, the Environmental Protection Agency, has announced its intention to use its existing authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate large sources of carbon, such as coal-fired power plants, directly. And a report published today, also by the Centre for Biological Diversity, shows how this existing authority could allow Obama to carry through a programme of action under existing legislation that would be consistent with the current science of 350 parts per million. So it is still possible. It still can be done.
Phil England spoke with Anna Keenan from the Australian Conservation Foundation about the response from young people to climate change.
The one really wonderful thing for me that came out of Poznan, the Poznan conference, was this coming together of young people from all over the world. They arrived at this conference and more becoming interested in the UN process, because they see that these climate negotiations are very directly about our future. And that was probably the first time when we realised that the climate movement, the youth climate movement in particular, had this massive reach. It wasn't just all of these organisations in different countries all around the world. It was actually a global network. We have youth climate campaigners in the USA and Australia and Europe, but also in Asia, and we met a lot of them as we travelled through overland from Singapore to Poland. We have youth climate campaigners in Africa and in South America and in the Middle East. So from Lebanon there's an organisation called INDIACT, and they're amazing. And we met all of these people and we thought, look at the power of this global movement, and it's growing every year. There were 400, 500 young people at the Poland conference. At COP15 this year, there's expected to be at least 1,000 young people. It's wonderful. And out of this youth movement was born, you know, a number of different campaigns, but one that most people probably know about is 350.org. So 350.org Global Day of Action that happened on October 24 this year has come straight out of the youth movement. And there's some really wonderful people from America that kicked that off, but then they took advantage of that global network of young people all around the world, and we jumped on the opportunity to participate in that.
One such young person, Murray from Climate Camp, has been involved in the Bike Block, an artwork to be used in a direct action on the Day of Action on the 16th of December in Copenhagen. Tom Besley caught up with him in Bristol.
Okay, so I'm standing outside the Arnolfini Centre with Murray, who's from the Bike Block. Do you want to describe the scene in front of us?
Yeah, sure. In front of us now, we've got about 10 or 12 people all looking over the most incredible array of bits of bikes. You've got frames, half frames, two bikes welded together, and some really odd looking mutant bikes.
Shopping trolley with wheels on it.
Yeah, shopping trolley with wheels on it. Everything from tiny little 16 inch little folding bikes all the way through to like the like frames of what were once great mountain bikes, all here and all being torn to pieces because they're no longer needed and wanted for something better.
And what is this new future for these bikes?
I mean, in the short term, the new future is going to be kind of for us to use as prototypes for when we go to Copenhagen. Basically, this is all about trying out new things, learning, and also learning new skills, getting people learning welding, angle grinding, metalwork, and just simple stuff like bike repair. It's amazing how many people just don't know how to like strip apart and rebuild bikes. So there's been a huge amount of like skill sharing between everyone here.
Excellent. So have you had members of the public come down?
Yeah, definitely. We've had loads of people who've been dropping by, seeing what's going on, and like lots of people from all over the country have been coming down here to get involved and kind of find out what's happening.
I think it's this lovely idea that members of the public might come down and think they're learning a lesson about how to fix a puncture, when in fact they're kind of contributing to like quite a serious direct action that's going to happen in December.
It's a beautiful thing, it really is. It's that like fantastic mix of like really innocent practicality with this like more mysterious undercurrent of what's going to be happening in Copenhagen. But it's really good. It should, like, there shouldn't be those like strict barriers between like members of the public and activists.
Absolutely.
And like bike repair and civil disobedience. It's like all on a scale. I think it's really good to show that there isn't some like weird hole where like weird people in like black scarves sit and like plot actions. It's just normal people sitting around and working away on bikes.
And you can do it at home. I mean, that's the best thing. How long have you been? About 40 days, I think. How long has the Bike Block been on the harbour side?
Oh, I'm not sure. I've only just been down here for the last couple of days.
Okay.
I've literally just got down and got involved now. Sorry.
So has there been any indication like of any kind of secure plans. So I know that this was going to be like prototype building,
yeah,
and then the prototypes are going to be kind of like carried out and like made again in Copenhagen. Are there any like firm plans? Has some designs come into being that people are happy with kind of including, or is it still a bit?
No, definitely, it's going pretty well. We've successfully made a double-double bike, which is, we've got two double bikes, and we're now working on making a double-double bike. And we've also got this fantastic thing where we're just putting, like, the frame of another bike on the rear of one, so you can use it as, like, a sort of shield and crowd control technique.
Wow.
As well as, like, a mode of transport, and we're currently working out how you can balance a second person on them.
Yeah.
Trying to turn, like, a normal bike into a, like, tandem. Yeah. But, yeah, it's coming on really well. It's fantastic. Really impressive, and we've only really been building for the last couple of days, so...
Yeah.
Once we've had like 10 days in Copenhagen, then who knows?
It's going to be incredible. So the day of action, the 16th, it's going to be something. Well, we'll be there. We'll have to catch up and talk more about how it's gone for you, like how it's gone for the bikes. Do you know what's going to happen to the bikes? You know, will they become property of the Danish police, or what's going to happen to the double trouble?
Well, you know, hopefully we'll be able to use it on that day and take it back and use it for future events. But I guess that's not necessarily up to us.
Awesome, excellent. Well, we should catch up and find out the fate later on. Thanks very much.
Definitely. Thank you.
There's a growing understanding that carbon markets will not deliver the rapid global decarbonisation that is required to avoid dangerous climate change. And yet, this is the central policy tool that Europe and the US would like to see in the final Copenhagen deal. Out on the streets of Denmark next week, and in the parallel People's Summit on Climate Change, that is also taking place in Copenhagen right now, protesters and voices from the global south will be making clear their understanding of carbon markets and offsetting as a full solution. Here's the second part of Fillingland's interview with Sarah Jane Clifton, author of The Friends of the Earth Critique of Carbon Trading as a Solution to Climate Change, A Dangerous Obsession.
You've mentioned earlier that the UK and the EU have kind of been instrumental in pushing this particular policy and has kind of been promoting it worldwide because they were the first people to establish a region-wide scheme.
Yeah.
But the real driver behind that is what?
We would argue that a big driver behind that is, as you said, the fact that we have an existing scheme and that there are certain kind of financial interests within the UK and European Union who already have a kind of big vested interest in keeping that scheme going and seeing it expanded and seeing opportunities for kind of investment in the carbon markets to expand globally. So as you said, the EU is a big driver for the expansion of carbon trading. There's a European Commission announcement in December-January time where they set out plans to link the European Emissions Trading Scheme to a US scheme and then to link those schemes to other carbon trading schemes across the OECD and also to support the development of carbon trading in advanced developing countries. And then what you've seen more recently is the UK government taking that up really and sort of filling in the detail. So the UK government published a big report in July by the Prime Minister's Special Representative on Carbon Trading, Mark Lazarowicz MP, which was a sort of vision for a joined up global carbon market. Friends of the Earth is incredibly concerned really about this drive to expand carbon trading. I mean, I think as we've already discussed, there is really fundamental problems with carbon trading as a solution for tackling carbon emissions, and we think that relying on this as a way of tackling climate change is very high risk and actually very irresponsible. And what you're seeing also is this kind of emphasis on carbon trading crowding out some of the much more important discussions that need to be had about the real drivers of climate change, about the unsustainable consumption patterns which are actually have caused climate change in the first place and which we aren't really anywhere near starting to tackle yet.
Looking into the future with what the EU is kind of planning, they're saying that now that the Clean Development Mechanism, which is people have really discovered is not working, and so now they're kind of abandoning that, it seems, and they want to move towards this sectoral trading idea, which, as far as I understand it, that the the level of discussions, as I was able to discern from the Earth Negotiations Bulletin from the last round of UN talks, was that basically people were saying, we don't really understand this, can you give us some more detail? I mean, that's the level of it, and yet that is the whole basis for the EU's drive forward in this and kind of policy and negotiating platform at Copenhagen. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think you're right in highlighting that a lot of people don't understand the proposals around sectoral trading. I mean, we certainly heard that from quite a number of the developing country parties in the Barcelona talks, that it's incredibly complex, and that is a really big concern. What you find is the EU is kind of driving, putting forward proposals on markets and trading mechanisms in lots of different places in the negotiations, and as you're probably aware, the negotiations themselves are very, very complicated with lots of different tracks, and there's a real imbalance in terms of countries' ability to participate and negotiate in those different tracks. So, you know, the EU delegation is, you know, often, you know, up to sort of 100 people or more strong. Same with the delegations of individual EU countries are very, very big, but some of the developing countries only have one or two negotiators there. So it's incredibly hard for many developing countries to actually keep track on all the different proposals that are being put forward. And it would seem very clearly that the EU is trying to get these references to different types of carbon trading mechanisms in wherever it can. So if they get knocked out in one place, then they've got them in other places. But you're right, it's a really big concern that the sectoral trading proposals could get through with very, very little scrutiny and, you know, lots of developing countries not really understanding what they mean. And what they actually do mean is they necessitate binding emissions reduction targets for developing countries, whereas the convention itself, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and the Bali Action Plan are very, very clear in saying there's a sequencing here that needs to take place because of the historical responsibility of rich countries for causing the problem of climate change. That all countries obviously need to take action to tackle climate change, but because of the disproportionate contribution of rich countries need to cut their emissions first and fastest, then at the same time provide the finance to developing countries to help them or to support them in tackling climate change, and then the developing countries themselves can start to take action on their own emissions. Whereas sectoral trading necessitates binding targets on developing countries much, much, much sooner.
What about in terms of policies to get the job done, to actually, that might be more effective than carbon trading is currently? Things like direct regulation, perhaps. I mean, I know that in the States, actually, Obama and the Environmental Protection Agency have an existing authority under the Clean Air Act, which they're not exercising yet, and might also be traded away in order to get a kind of bill through Congress, but he does have existing regulation to regulate against coal-fired power stations there.
Right, and that's not being used at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, we definitely support the use of proven, tried and tested policy tools. One of the big concerns, obviously, with carbon trading is it's so far unproven, but there are lots of other types of policy tools which are out there which are available to governments which have been proven to be effective at doing similar jobs to tackling emissions in the past. So really, like you said, regulation, direct intervention by governments in the form of setting standards, there's a really, really big role for that. And experience within the EU has shown already that that's been very effective at kind of creating incentives for heavily polluting industries to change their behaviour. Lots of good examples like the EU's Large Combustion Plant Directive, the Integrated Pollution Prevention and Control Directive, that latter one that is based on this principle called best available technology. So you're really driving improvements within an industrial sector based on which of the companies has the most sort of is the most progressive and has the best available technology in place. So we very much support the use by governments of direct regulation and intervention to to actually bring down emissions. But we also think there is a really big role for public investment, that a lot of the problem is that the alternative technologies that are needed, they simply aren't available at the moment at prices which are accessible. And there is a lot more investment which is needed in research, development and deployment of technologies. And we think that investment has to be made by governments initially to ensure that those technologies become available. And then there's also a really big role for a need for public investment in things like energy efficiency, in sustainable transport infrastructure, a big role for governments to use public procurement to start to, you know, and make those sort of bigger changes in our national infrastructures to try and bring down emissions.
I mean, the other thing that seems to be dominating the, and maybe it's not coincidental or accidental, but dominating the kind of political discussion in the media here in the UK is this idea that we need to cut public spending. But actually, when things hit rock bottom in the United States after the Great, during the Great Depression, that's not how FDR got out of the situation, was it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the New Deal, and there are lots of proposals out there for a Green New Deal, in which public investment is a really big plays a really big role in helping to make helping our countries to make the transition to low carbon economies. The other thing which we haven't discussed yet, and really which is really important to be aware of, are the benefits for us in actually making those changes, and the benefits that will come for the government and for the economy if we do actually start to switch to make those changes in reducing emissions. If you look at for example, Germany, it already has 10% more people employed in the renewable energy sector than in the UK. So there's lots of potential for new jobs in green industries and lots more business opportunities for small and medium-sized companies that will come from governments starting to intervene and both regulate to reduce emissions and also make the investments that need to be made. And this is we very much support some of the proposals that are coming through and the proposals for a Green New Deal. And seeing governments commit the investments which will have knock-on benefits, not just from a kind of sustainability point of view, but also for the health of our economy.
One of the big things that I did want to ask was about the kind of discussions that might be going on within the actual meetings within the United Nations process, and particularly the kind of developing world view on carbon markets and how useful they are, actually, and whether that debate is shifting, and whether people are kind of waking up to the fact that actually it might not be the best thing for them or for the planet.
I think you're right. I think there's definitely growing awareness about carbon trading and concern about carbon markets approaches. There is still, I think, as you highlighted earlier, a big lack of awareness about some of the proposals on carbon trading and what they actually mean, and that's really concerning. But what's already very clear is that developing countries they do not want to see finance from offsetting through the carbon markets for their what are called NAMAs, their nationally appropriate mitigation actions, which are their actions to actually start kind of reducing their emissions domestically. The G77 plus China, which is the group of around 135 developing countries, has a very clear position, which is that NAMAs are not financed through offsetting, i.e. essentially through the carbon markets. They need to be financed through public finance. Lots of different individual countries are very critical of that, India being one of them. Brazil is very, very clearly against new kind of sectoral offsetting through carbon markets. I think what you do see is some of the poorer countries who are obviously desperately in need of the finance, which is not forthcoming, looking to see whether, you know, if the public finances, if rich countries are not going to provide the public finance that they're obliged to, then maybe then the carbon markets provide that opportunity, and there may be some possibility to at least get some money through the carbon markets. But I think what we have seen is developing countries, you know, being much stronger now about pushing rich countries to actually deliver on their commitment to provide the public finance, which is a really, really positive development.
there's also some kind of discussion about perhaps putting a cap on the use of offsets. Is that within the Kyoto Protocol track?
Yeah, that was a great development in Barcelona, in the Barcelona negotiations, where the African countries were so frustrated with the lack of progress on the, in the Kyoto Protocol track, the lack of progress from developed countries in putting forward firm targets for their emissions reductions commitments. Under the second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol. So they were supposed to put forward their targets in March, and they've been dragging their feet all year. And finally, in Barcelona in October, the African countries said, enough is enough. This is really not acceptable. How are we expected to actually negotiate on these things if you're not even putting firm numbers on the table? And that temporarily brought the negotiations to a halt, and then things were reconvened with a commitment to spend a lot more of the time negotiating on the targets. But then one of the demands which the African and other developing countries made after that was when the developed countries do propose their targets, that they state very explicitly what proportion of that will be domestic action and what proportion of that will be offsetting. So I think, again, that's an area where the developing countries are being much stronger. They're actually wanting that transparency. They're very aware of the implications of the offsetting component for the ambition of developed countries to reduce their emissions and what that means, both for our chances of avoiding catastrophic climate change. I mean, in October, in the negotiations, Kenya was talking about, you know, we're not talking about climate change as being this thing which will happen at some distant point in the future. It's something which is happening already now, and which is impacting on developing countries and on the lives of poor communities in developing countries now. I mean, Kenya was suffering very bad droughts at the time, and I think that is kind of one of the key drivers behind, you know, being much stronger and much unified in calling on developed countries to actually fulfil the obligations that they've made.
It seemed like not all the countries were actually willing to disclose what percentage were they were counting as offsets. Do you know which countries are withholding that information?
No, I'm not aware of that. I mean, I think a lot of them have provided information, but there are lots of ways in which kind of the numbers are being misrepresented. So some countries are obviously putting forward different baselines for their targets, as if somehow that's going to make the targets look more ambitious than they are. And all of those things really just, they don't help with building trust in the negotiations.
Another thing that seems to be being slipped through fairly quietly is possibly including credits for carbon capture and storage and nuclear in the clean development mechanism.
Yes, and other things as well. There's a big drive, for example, to include agriculture in the carbon markets. And as we said before, these things are all very, very concerning, and very much kind of also a distraction from some of the main issues which are supposed to be being done in the COP in Copenhagen.
What was he saying? What was he saying?
We have been suffering too much for the things which we have done in the past.
Okay.
So it's now we are going to stand firm behind our negotiators.
Okay.
So they should negotiate for a better deal.
Okay.
And not We don't want the political deal.
Okay.
And
who is he? Who's the man that was speaking?
What is his name who was speaking? He is one of the negotiators.
One of the negotiators. And what country is he from?
He should be from which country is he from? Central Africa. That country is in the nearby.
Central Africa. Thank you for your help. Behind me just now was a large impromptu demonstration of African delegates. One of the people in the crowd who didn't want to be recorded told me that he saw one of the chief negotiators, Lumumba D. Apping, from the G77 group, a Sudanese negotiator, walk into an African civil society meeting, the Pan-African Civil Society grouping, and burst into tears. He said, they are forcing us to sign a suicide pact. And then he called upon the civil society to reject the whole deal. Prior to this demonstration, John Vidal broke a story in The Guardian a few hours ago about a so-called Danish text, a secret draft agreement worked on by a group of individuals known as the Circle of Commitment, but understood to include the UK, the US and Denmark, which had only been shown to a handful of countries. I'm quoting there from John Vidal's story in The Guardian this morning. The person I spoke to in the crowd then said that this was true, that Lumumba Diaping had confirmed that a deal had been offered, and he called upon Africans to reject it, saying, I would rather die with my dignity than sign a deal that will channel my people into a furnace. The slogan we just heard in the crowd was, one Africa, one degree, 2 degrees is suicide. This is Frederica Whitehead reporting live from Copenhagen at the Climate Summit Conference. We're going straight to broadcast now, but we will follow up on this story and get more of the background and analysis for you for tomorrow's programme.
To Copenhagen Daily, every day from 11 a.m. till noon, throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.